So, we were running this nice, but not as nice as MC Robot, which is the original. And this thing is undergoing Markov chain Monte Carlo sampling. There's some sort of boundary here. You know, it doesn't allow it to go beyond that. There's like a reflecting boundary or something at the edge. I don't quite know why it's spending all its time over there, but oh, here it comes. The question is it ever going to find that other peak? And at the moment, I'd say it's not doing a very good job of finding it. Maybe you can. There's a lot of technology of Markov chain Monte Carlos and Carlo methods, and I have not told you most of it. Maybe I'll do one little derivation. But for example, why is it that the acceptance formula, the new density over the old density, why setting your random number to that, checking whether a random number is less than that, why does that in fact give you the right distribution? There's a derivation in the book actually showing you that it will. And then there's all sorts of other complications, one of which is if there's a proposal distribution here, which is, as far as I know, probably, it's something like a rectangular window around the current position. You just pick positions in that rectangular window. You can control the size of the window, and I think what I'll do is make the window a bit bigger, and we'll see if this thing finds the right, the full distribution. You may wonder what's the right proposal distribution, but the interesting thing is that the theorems guarantee that provided there's some minimal conditions of things being connected, theorems say that it doesn't matter. It might be, for example, that you mostly propose motions horizontally and only occasionally vertically. That will still work if you run it long enough. And the same thing, you could say, well, suppose you had a proposal distribution that proposed mostly movements to the upper right and lower left and not quite as much the other way. Again, the theorems guarantee that if you run long enough, that will in fact still reach the same distribution. So the proposal distributions are important if you're able to sample. They're relatively unimportant if you're able to sample a great many times. But as you can see, you may need a lot of sampling in order to even find parts of the distribution. Let me try stopping the chain. And I'm going to clear the samples. Now it's starting over here. I'm going to show the controller. We're going to do one more thing. We're going to take the proposal window size and make it considerably, somewhat bigger anyway. Let's see if we can run the chain, see what happens now. Now it's actually jumping all over the place a lot. It's spending a lot of time there. It's moving rather wildly. I think we will find it revisiting this area. It's doing a pretty good job. It's ending up, although it sampled out here some, I'm hoping we will find it occasionally coming over here and sampling here because of the density of the distribution they're trying to sample from. It has a peak here and then it has a broader peak there. So it's having said that it's going to find that, I don't see it finding it. It found it briefly and then it wandered back over here. Well, that's embarrassing. Okay, I could try larger jumps. Wait, oh, almost. Yeah, there it went, and it's and it is sampling from there. So it's it is okay. That's an excellent example. Then I'm not embarrassed anymore. The number of samples taken here and the number of samples taken there are starting to get into a better proportion. But of course, you'd really want to let it go back and forth more times. There is all kinds of artistry involved in how do you know you've run long enough. There are theorems that involve effective sample size. And what that means is you can do calculations of how autocorrelated your samples are. But all those formulas are really just assuming there's one nice smooth peak. And if you actually have larger numbers of peaks, you have to watch out. Those formulas don't work terribly well. Well, here it's getting quite a... This must be a relatively narrow but higher peak. I think they too may contain the same amount of volume. I'm not really sure. I'd have to read up on the program. So it's staying here and sampling quite a lot, but you know you'll see it get back and forth. So this is doing and notice it's not spending time up here or down there. It's being guided by the heights of the functions and getting you a somewhat reasonable result. Now, this is just for mixtures of a couple of normal distribution-shaped bumps, not a space of trees. And the question comes up, well, what's the corresponding activity when you have a space of trees? And there we have, if you recall, tree topologies. And we had this whole picture that I painted earlier that if you take a branch length in the tree and you shorten it. Let's see if I'm trying to remember if I in fact did tell you of this. Where did I discuss the tree space and going through the looking glass? Did I do any of that? I guess I didn't. Okay. Imagine a bunch of tree topologies. And imagine, I think this will be, there'll be a figure on this in the next week's course projection. So let me see if I can call that up and quickly get it. And not that one. Let me know. Just a moment. No, I will. What I will do, get you the last year's version of the, There we go. So now, with a little bit of luck, let's lower that. Our sampling window seems to have vanished. I'm not really sure what happened. Here we go. Yeah, there it is, still doing its thing. Spending a lot of time in the lower left.
Notice the default temperature is pretty low. Maybe that's... Could that be the...
Well, the... The thing is sampling from the surface, and there is a thing called temperature, which you haven't explained to everybody else what you were talking about. And this is sampling at a temperature of 1, which means that it is sampling just from that distribution. If I raise the height, if I take the vertical heights and I raise them to a power, such as squaring them, that would sample from a temperature of half as much. This is being analogized to a physical system where there's Brownian motion and heat or not, or less heat. If you change this temperature by raising the thing to a power, it samples in a more concentrated or less concentrated way.
So
but not from this original distribution that's now sampling from a modified version of it. I didn't want to go there, actually. Okay. However, in thinking about how you do sampling, I want to talk a little bit about tree space. And I think it will be found... I'm sorry about that. I can use this diagram. It'll be good enough. There was another one I was thinking of. Here is a case where we have three rooted trees. It's one of the simplest possible cases. I'll be getting this when we talk about likelihood ratio tests, which we're going to get to almost immediately. And there are branch lengths here. Now, in this case, they're clock-like trees, so there actually are times of the nodes. But in unrooted cases, you have lengths of the branches. The trees are connected with each other in the sense that if you take a branch and you consider what happens if you shrink an internal branch to zero, you can do this in either a rooted or an unrooted tree. As you reach that point, you get to a trifurcation. And as you get to the trifurcation, there are three different ways of resolving that trifurcation, of putting in a little branch. And one of them is the one you came from, and here are the other two. So in a sense, what I like to say is you can take any internal branch of, let's say, an unrooted tree. This is rooted, but an unrooted tree. Shrink a branch length to zero. Now, if you think of all the branches in the tree, they are real numbers, and they're non-negative. Because a negative branch length doesn't really have any meaning. And you can think, therefore, of the tree as being a function of those parameters, and that makes it a real space in however many dimensions. So if you had, in this case, if these were unrooted trees, let me not talk about these trees. If you had an unrooted tree that had, say, seven branches, that means there are seven parameters. It means you're in a seven-dimensional real space, except that none of the quantities is able to go negative. And that means it's what's called an orthant. So it's a corner of a real space. So if I had a point here, we're in a three-dimensional space, I can move that point in any of three dimensions, up, left, right, forward, back. But if I go to the wall is zero. That's the point where the branch length has reached zero. I can't have a negative one, so we sort of have to say, okay, when we hit the wall, we take an internal branch, bring its length to zero, we hit the wall. Now we're at a trifurcation. Because it's a trifurcation, there's another space, we can think of it as being on the other side of the wall, that's a different tree topology that has the property when one of its branches is reduced to zero length, that reaches the same trifurcation. And in fact, the trifurcation is a part of this space, it's a part of that space, and it's a part of another one. So basically what happens when you take an internal branch of a tree and you shrink it, you reach zero, you reach the boundary of that space, that chunk of real space, that orthant of a real space, corner of a real space. And that boundary point is also part of two other spaces. So what I like to talk about is you walk towards the wall by shrinking the branch. And when you hit the wall, you pass through the wall, and before you are two other worlds. And you get to choose which of those two worlds you step into. And so you emerge from the other side into coming out of the wall in one of those spaces and lengthening this internal branch. So what we have are, and what you will have done in going from this to this is a nearest neighbor interchange rearrangement. I told you about those. They're kind of fundamental to the geometry of tree space. And nearest neighbor interchanges take you to things which share the same wall and share the trifurcation, a particular trifurcation. So you can think of them as being a space of these topologies connected to each other by nearest neighbor interchanges. You may recall that way back when we were talking about tree rearrangement, I showed you such a diagram, the Schoenberg graph for five tips of unrooted trees. So those are the diagrams of which trees share common walls. And so we can either move around within one tree topology, changing branch lengths, or we can go to a wall and pass into another tree topology. Bayesian programs in doing sampling very often do those operations. That is, they have a proposal distribution which will include changing branch lengths in the topology you're in, but sometimes going to neighboring topologies by things like nearest neighbor interchanges. And so what you'll have is a program that is wandering among tree topologies and wandering within each tree topology, wandering among branch lengths. And there's all sorts of artistry about what are good proposal distributions, and there is no comprehensive mathematical theory that tells you which is the best one. Just different people have different ones. And, it's good to mix together sampling of nearby trees that just change branch lengths and some nearby topologies with occasional forays further out in hopes of finding isolated peaks. Now, I guess the other thing to say is that you're not just changing, let me see if I can find, nope, that's not it, that's MCMCF, but it's not it. I was looking for that window. Nope. Keep clicking on the same one. Where is it? Nope. Still not. Still not it. Yeah, here it is. Okay. It's really sampling the heck out of this guy. This must be a very high peak because it hasn't come back over here at all to sample. So now, actually, maybe I'm not illustrating that things are doing too well. Although this is a very high peak, it should have spent more time over here. It's just having trouble finding it. Out of curiosity, I'll do one more run. I'll stop the chain, clear the samples. I'll start running the chain, and then I'll stop it and clear it again. See, well, no, it's not moving that square anywhere. All right. Anyway, it's doing a lot. Now it's more like it was at the beginning of the last run. Maybe it'll get over here again. Anyway, I want to show you a more real example, but let me talk for a moment about one other kind of sampling that happens with Bayesian inference of phylogenies. And that is, you can have movements in tree space, but you also have parameters of your biological model. You have things like equilibrium base frequencies, transition transversion rates, shape of the gamma distribution, if you have a gamma distribution of rates. So you have a bunch of parameters. Now, as we'll see when we do maximum likelihood, you can estimate those by maximum likelihood as well as estimating the tree. What you do with Bayesian inference is a bit different. You'll be provided with a prior, you're provided with or you choose a prior distribution of trees. And the inference is dependent on that prior. But you're also given a prior distribution on the parameters. If you don't want to set them to fixed values, you can say, well, I don't know what the transition transversion rate is. Let's choose it from a distribution, a prior distribution on it. And then what has to happen is, as you do the sampling, you also have to try new values for the parameters. So you think of yourself as wandering not just in tree space, but in tree plus parameter space. So you have tree topologies, you have branch lengths, and you have parameter values. And a new proposal will consist of maybe a new tree topology, maybe new branch lengths, maybe new parameter values, nearby parameter values. And so then you collect a big sample. Now here's a sample, okay. And what you'll have is one thing to think of is, well, we want to get some idea of a sample from the posterior distribution. Each of these points that it jumps to is a potential sample. Sometimes, just to avoid having too big a sample size, too many samples, they will take every 10th one or every 100th one. But sometimes you'll take the ball. And they will give you a good picture. And they also will come with parameter values. They may have changed the they're somewhere in parameter space as well. So basically, the program is going to save a whole bunch of those. And if you, for example, want to know about the parameter values, you can also look at the posterior distribution of parameter values. You can say, well, what transition-transversion rates does it think are plausible in light of that prior, but in light of the data? So you get both samples from the tree and samples from parameter values. And then there comes the issue, and I'll stop this here. And then comes, go back to somehow. No, all right, more. I wanted to get back to the, okay. Get back over here. Nope. We have to go back and find the course projections. I don't know where they went. And here we go, back to week 7. What we do, well, let me say this and then I'll talk about summarizing things. When you're doing the acceptance machinery for a Bayesian inference of phylogeny and also perhaps parameter values, what you do use as your acceptance ratio is this, because the posterior you're talking about is not just probability, doesn't involve just probability of the data given t, it involves the prior probability of the prior probability of the tree times the probability of the data given the tree. That's that numerator in the Bayesian inference, and the denominators are going to cancel. And so the acceptance ratio will be an assessment of where the new tree is on the prior as well as how well it fits the data. So you use that. And model parameters, when I talk about these t's, you have to also think of them as incorporating as well parameter values. Okay. Well, if you do this, there's a set of data of 14 species of mostly primates. I will show it to you again when we get to bootstraps, which is coming up very quickly. It's the same set of mitochondrial sequences that Masami Hasegawa assembled out of the work of some of his colleagues sequencing them in the 1980s. Those 200, it's not a huge amount of data, it's 232 nucleotides of mitochondrial DNA. If I take Mr. Bayes, which is the leading, it's certainly the most widely used Bayesian program, Bayesian inference program for phylogenies, and I make some choices about models. I think it was perhaps an HKY model or something like that in a particular transition transversion rate. And I run it. We get a big cloud of trees. And the question is, what can you do about that? Can you just look at the trees one at a time? And one of the things that is most useful to look at is how often different clades are present. Or the other way of thinking about it, if it's unrooted trees, is how often different partitions of the species are present. So, for example, how often do we see the five, in this case five, they're really a little more, they're two species of chimp and a bunch of species of gibbon, but here we have five of them. How often is this group present among those trees? Now, I'll talk as we get to bootstraps about using a majority rule consensus tree machinery for assessing that. what this is doing is basically, for each tree, keeping track of which clades are present. And then at the end, showing you the most frequently present clades. So, for example, it turns out that lemur and tarsier, a branch separating lemur and tarsier from everybody else, is present almost 90% of the time, in almost 90% of the samples. The macaques, there's these four highly closely related macaques here, rhesus macaque, crab-eating macaque, Japanese macaque, and Barbary macaque. And they're present, essentially, this group is present all the time, 100% of the time, this one 100% of the time among these samples, and this one 999 times out of 1,000. So they're very, very frequent. Almost all the trees have this group. Human next chimp 99.7% of the time. Human chimp gorilla as a clade 98% of the time. These four great apes 90% of the time, and the apes 94% of the time. But not all groups are present in that high a frequency. The old world monkeys plus apes are present 93% of the time, but then some of the other groups are not so common. Bovine Kaz cow with lemur and tarsier is 41% of the time. So among all the trees, 59% of them don't have that group. It's broken up in one way or another. Likewise, let's see, if you bring in the squirrel monkey, which is a New World monkey, then the group of all the monkeys and apes is 85% of the time. There is here a little bit of indication that maybe this group isn't real, and in fact it's not real. The cow has sneaked in. Mouse is sort of an outgroup here, and the cow has sneaked in and is near the lemur and tarsier. In fact, actually, work with other molecules indicates the tarsier isn't even supposed to be there. The tarsier is actually, more closely related. It should be splitting off before the monkeys and apes, but the lemur should have split off earlier. If you rooted the tree out here, tarsier should come off here and not be up there with lemur. It's not that closely related. I should say that the horizontal scale here is misleading because it's just to show you the branching things. There are branch lengths here. There's then a very real question of how do you draw the diagram to draw branch lengths, because you have this cloud of trees and they all have somewhat different branch lengths. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can make up arbitrary schemes. You can say, we'll take all the times that a group is present, say all 93% of the time that the group is present, and we'll measure the branch length of this branch, which is present in those cases, and then average its length. That would be an acceptable way. And we'll give you a diagram that looks, the branch lengths look a little bit different. But here's an example of a Bayesian program. As we'll see when we see the bootstrap, these support values are higher than you get in a bootstrap. It's because bootstrap values are lower. They're biased downwards. High bootstrap values are biased downwards. These are supposedly not as biased. Okay, so there's a simple example, and you've seen an example of sampling by markup chain Monte Carlo. So there are good programs out there to do this. Mr. Bayes is probably the simplest. Now, I have a bunch of qualms about Bayesian inference, and I have to give you a warning. I'm a curmudgeon on the subject. I wrote a chapter in my book that's somewhat negative about Bayesian inference. That is not necessarily typical of people in the field. Bayesian methods are very popular. There are people talk of a Bayesian revolution that has swept away all previous methods. I'd like to believe that's not true. But in terms of popularity, Bayesian methods are extraordinarily popular. Partly because they give you the very thing you'd want, namely the probability of that your hypothesis is true. Okay. But they give it to you if you give the method prior distributions. Okay. Now, I have to say that the Bayesian, the rather negative Bayesian chapter in my book is very unpopular, and most of the people doing Bayesian inference say, well, they sort of like my book, but boy, that chapter is terrible. So you will hear negative comments about the chapter. Why was he so negative? There's a lot more that should be said, and so on. So I just wanted to give you that warning. The issues, I think, that arise with Bayesian inference, the main issue is where do you get your prior from? People may tell you, they may say, oh, I'll use this one, everybody uses it, or use this one, people have used it for a long time and they all got tenure. But there really is the issue of the prior. Because if you have a valid prior, there's no argument against using it. I mean, no one could object to your using it. No one could object to interpreting the data as providing you with a probability that particular hypotheses, particular trees, for example, are true. And for example, one kind of prior that's often used is to assume that each branch on the tree has a length drawn independently from the distribution. They also will assume that the tree topologies, that you'll take all possible tree topologies and choose uniformly from among those tree topologies. Then there's the issue, well, what are the branch lengths? There will be a distribution going from zero up towards infinity of branch lengths. But then the question comes up, as well, how wide a distribution? How big branch lengths should you be? You know, you might be a distribution like an exponential distribution. There's no upper limit, but there is a width of that distribution. So are you considering only rather small, mostly rather small branch lengths, or a lot of large ones as well? What tells you that? The other thing that can happen is it's become increasingly popular not to use a uniform distribution of tree topologies plus independent branch lengths, independently drawn branch lengths, but to use a tree that's drawn from a birth-death process. So you say, well, let's generate the tree, let's assume the true trees come from a process of particles successively splitting through time. If they just split, that's called a pure birth process. If they split at random times, then there are what are called birth and death processes, where they split and then some die off and more splitting occurs until finally you get a tree with the right number of species. It gets a little fuzzy as to when to stop. And what about things like the rates of birth and death in those processes? Where did you get those from? And then here's a real kicker. What if you try to make a probabilistic model of how the tree, you know, what is the prior distribution of the tree, you have to also take into account one other step. And that step is how were the species studied chosen from all extant species of the group. So you're studying sparrows. There may be hundreds of species of sparrows, but maybe you're not going to study all hundreds of them. You'll study some sampled ones. Well, then there's a process going on in your head as to how did you choose from among the wealth of possible sparrows the ones that you wanted to study. Often it will be something like this. It'll be something like, I'm particularly interested in this particular group of sparrows, but I'd like to throw in a few to be out groups. So we'll really take every sample we can possibly get in that group, and then we'll throw in a few samples, you know, many fewer than are available to be out groups. So one of the questions that comes up is if you wanted to make a probabilistic model of this process, you've got to put in a psychological part of it. That is, you have to model a process occurring in the brain of the systematist. Now, what people often do is they say, well, we'll assume sampling, we'll say that you generate all, you consider that out there is a process that generates all possible spirals, and then we're going to study a random 30% of them, or a random 20% of them. The problem is, I think actual biologists studying groups don't really choose their species that way. They tend to concentrate in some areas much more than in others. So now I suggest that this is important, and in terms of making a parameterized distribution of a prior distribution of trees, this part will drive you crazy. That way lies madness. Because we're now not talking about models of biological processes, we're talking about models of how systematists or how molecular evolutionists think. And I don't want to go there.
Okay, so there is the issue where you get your prior from, but then there's another issue.
Suppose you get a prior and you say, I think this is pretty good, I'm going to use it. And you do the runs, they look good, and you go to publish them. Well, there is the issue of whether your prior is the same as your reader's prior. The reader is going to have to accept your, you know, you could describe how you got the prior, and the reader might discount your paper if they don't like the prior. But there is at least an issue of, is there some controversy between you and the reader as to who, as to what the prior ought to be? So that's another one. And I don't think I could guarantee that you will have a prior the same as, you will find acceptable a prior that's the same as mine. Okay. If not, what do you do? Well, somebody could say, okay, maybe we shouldn't assume the reader has the same prior, so maybe we should provide some information so they can use their prior. Well, what would that mean? That would mean we'll provide them with a likelihood surface, and then they can apply their own prior to it. Well, that isn't done in practice because it's too difficult to convey that. But at that point, you're kind of retreating away from Bayesian inference, and you're saying, well, each of us will have a Bayesian inference, but they aren't the same because they don't have the same priors. So I'll just give you the likelihood part of all of this.
Okay. Should you use several priors? Will they cover the right range and so on? Okay. I wanted to give you an idea. Let's see. Of an issue, another issue that arises, part of the issue of where'd you get the prior from, and I have a simple numerical example of it. Because often people will come and say, well, look, the prior should be as uninformative as possible, so we'll make a uniform prior. Well, there is then the issue of a uniform on what scale? And what I wanted to do is show you that issue as it arises when we have two species, Jukes-Kander model. So in effect, we're just making a two-species tree, so it's essentially also a distance calculation. It's what you do when you estimate distances. Well, you may recall that with Jukes-Kander, the sufficient statistic for the data is the fraction of sites that are different. Okay. So you can think of the distance between two species as being reflected in their estimated branch length or in the resulting fraction of difference. Those are two different scales you could look at. They map one to one. You can go back and forth between them using the Jukes-Kander formula here. If I take the probability, the fraction of difference between them, and I say, well, let's put a prior on it that's uniform over its possible value, 0 to 0.75. Okay. And I say, okay, let's let that be a good prior. Well, somebody else could come along and say, no, the branch length is the thing you're interested in. You should use a prior on branch lengths. And here is what this prior on branch lengths is that prior on p-values, that prior on fraction of difference. So in assuming a uniform between 0 and 0.75,
you are assuming, in effect, a prior on branch lengths that looks like that. It's not flat. So what's flat on one scale is not flat on another. And there is a very real question as to, well, uninformative on what scale? And it can look more informative on another scale. So there's a little bit of fuzz there. I wanted also to show, let's see, what did I just, yeah. Here, suppose I take the T scale, I take this scale, and I say, no, let's not use that. Let's use a flat prior on this branch length scale. But then somebody will say, well, wait a second, the branch length scale goes from 0 to infinity. What do you mean a flat prior from 0 to infinity? And there really is no such animal. So somebody can come along and say, well, look, T equal 5 is an awfully big branch length. It's a branch length so long that the average site is expected to change 5 times. It's, in effect, any signal of similarity between the sequences will have vanished by the time you get out that far. So let's just go from 0 to 5. We're not really going to find any branches longer than that in our tree. Okay, so there is T going from 0 to 5. Here is the corresponding prior on P. It has a lot of area way up near 0.75. Now, let's see. Let me do these next two figures and then come back to the previous ones. If I take my branch lengths and I put a flat prior on them out to some value, and then I have some data. In this case, I think the data was very small. It said that there were a modest number. I can't remember if it was 10 sites or 100 sites, and there were, it'll say in the text, and there was a 30% observed difference between the sequences. And I then take the posterior that resulted. Now, if I used a prior that went from 0 to 5, that will be here. The value I'm showing here is where you cut off the uniform distribution. I will get a posterior that, with those data, that has 95% of its area in this gray area. So the lower 2.5% will be here, and the upper 2.5 will start there and go upwards. But if I smear out my prior over a bigger range, if I go out to 100, I get a slight, I get a distribution that, because of the influence of the prior, stretches out further. Now the upper range is quite high. The lower range starts to sneak up. And it's even true that if I take a prior that's really wide, that the maximum likelihood value is actually down in the lower tail. It's down in the 2.5% tail. And I want to contrast that with the behavior of maximum likelihood. And I should say what is going on here is this, that you have a likelihood function, and if you make a uniform distribution from 0 to t as the prior and you multiply the two together, and then you choose the innermost, you choose so that 2.5% is in this tail and 2.5% is in that tail, if t is big enough, it can drag this middle 95% of the distribution out far enough to the right that it does not include the maximum likelihood value. Okay. Anyway, I'm giving you tendentious arguments again for worrying about priors, because I think people should not just assume that the prior that's provided by a program is okay, unless you want to be unless you don't want to think about these issues. An interesting detail is that maximum likelihood behaves a little bit differently.
if I take the same case, two sequences different, here it is, three sites out of 10, and I use the branch length as the scale, and I'm not doing Bayesian now, I'm just looking at the likelihood part. Here on the here's a log likelihood scale, here's the likelihood curve. The maximum likelihood inference, it will not surprise you, is at the point 0.383112. However, if you go look on the p scale and plot the same curve, but now against p rather than t, the two are functions of each other, the peak comes here. It is at the point p equal 0.3, the empirically observed fraction of differences. There it is. That is exactly the same point. If you go back and forth through the formula, it's exactly the same peak that you got on the other scale. So whichever scale you use with likelihood, the maximum likelihood estimate is the same. It's the corresponding point. However, if you do things like put uniform priors on them, those aren't the same. What is uniform on one scale is not uniform on the other. So maybe that's all I should really say about this. Where we're headed is to talk about using likelihood to test trees. That'll be Monday. And getting, as soon as I can, maybe around Wednesday, into the issue of bootstraps. Now, I realize that for the homework that you were given, you were asked to go out and do a bootstrap without me ever having told you what it was. For that, I apologize, but maybe I'll pretend that that is a deliberately good strategy. What I'm doing is making you look up stuff in advance and thus enhancing your educational experiences. I think the correct answer would be that if I rethought the homeworks, I probably wouldn't do that. I'll continue to answer questions as quickly as I can by email about the homeworks. But I'm hoping that there won't be any big problem. Okay, so let me let you go. And next time, things like likelihood ratio tests.